My name is Bill McGovern. I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center. Welcome back to the afternoon session. I hope everyone's well tanked up with chicken parm and caffeinated beverages. And so we'll get started here. The panel today, this panel is meant to flesh out further some of the privacy questions that were really getting raised repeatedly. So we're going to spend the next session looking at them in a more focused way, although I do think that we may still end up with more questions than answers, at least by the end of this panel. I'm sure by Wednesday it will all be solved, but not yet. I want to remind everyone that we have the question tool, and I certainly hope to be conveying questions to the panelists through that mechanism, so go ahead and pop some questions in as they occur to you. So what I'll do is I'll just briefly introduce the panelists and briefly make a couple of overarching comments, and then pass it off to each of the panelists to speak briefly and hopefully leave plentiful time for Q&A afterwards. So I'll just introduce in order. To my left is Ira Rubenstein, who is the Associate General Counsel of Regulatory Affairs and Public Policy, Law and Corporate Affairs at Microsoft. But what that really means is he's their legal guru for privacy, security, data encryption, spam, and a lot of related issues like that. Next up the table is Marg Rotenberg, the Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, a well-known advocacy group in D.C. on these issues. Mark's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches on data privacy, and the author of the main casebook used in law schools on the subject, the one that I'll probably be using when I'm teaching the subject.
Excellent.
Yeah, there you go. There's some sales. See, cha-ching, cha-ching, right there. And he's served on more advisory panels and done more congressional testimony than we have time to list over the next hour, so I won't. To his right is Roger Dingeldine, who's a privacy and anonymity advocate and expert, and who is certainly best known for being the leader in the development of the Tor system, which is an onion routing system for anonymization on the internet, and which he points out in his bio in the booklet is funded by both the U.S. Navy and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is probably the only person in the entire world who can make that claim. And finally, to my right, we've already met this morning, Christine Varney of Hogan & Hartson, a former member of the Federal Trade Commission and always a leader in internet privacy regulation issues long before most people realized there was a problem. She was already talking about that. So those are our panelists. It's a great group of experts to talk about this subject, and we can just launch right in. Let me introduce myself. I'm Bill McGovern. I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center, and I'm about to become a law professor at the University of Minnesota, where I'll teach data privacy, among other things. And one of the first articles I wrote back when I was a law student about 6 years ago was an analysis of this interesting new technological platform out there to try and help guarantee privacy. It was called P3P. Everyone remember this? And P3P was a set of protocols and tools, and a lot of people worked through a W3C process to develop it and assemble a very elaborate vocabulary and interoperability standards. And it was launched with great fanfare. And we don't use it, right? And so one of the perspectives I want to think about in this panel and throughout the next few days is I think the reasons that P3P didn't ever happen are complicated, but they include the fact that the market conditions and legal conditions were not there to usher it into existence or to make sure that it was in fact privacy improving as opposed to harmful to privacy. And so you'll see a theme running through a lot of the sessions around how law and market conditions support code, and that's something that we'll want to talk about today. I'm just going to do three quick hypos. I'm a law professor to be, right? So I do hypotheticals. So here are the three hypos I want you to think about, and perhaps our panelists will be able to shed some more light on them. The first, we've already had previewed from the back of the room by Rebecca McKinnon of the Berkman Center, the Chinese dissident activist and blogger who wants to use the power of the internet to speak. And a lot of people have voiced a concern that identity authentication tools that are baked into operating systems or otherwise can give the government in a country like China or other places with less freedom of speech than Western democracies have, the opportunity to authenticate the identity of speakers and thereby chill speech to a profound degree. So that's one hypo, is to what extent is the code that we're talking about building in this room potentially usable for that kind of application, and are there things that can be done at the coding stage to make that less possible? The second hypo is the data collector. Here, we're back in the US now. A lot of the discussion about the virtues of these tools has to do with the ability to ask for less information than the whole package, to ask just for that information which is necessary for the transaction that's occurring. But, of course, that requires that the data collector actually do so, that be the choice the data collector makes. And the question, I guess, again, in terms of the rollout of the supposedly neutral tool is that a realistic scenario? Will bigstore.com ask for more data, and will that data now, as a result of the way the interface is built, be easier to get? Will it be just a push of one button from the user's end to ship a lot of data? And will it be authenticated data, which potentially could be more valuable? And then the third hypo is about the authenticators and aggregators themselves, because, of course, as we've heard repeatedly this morning, one piece of data that you give often helps lead to other pieces of data about you, and particularly if you have an authenticating party that is ChoicePoint, for example. And it's entirely possible that companies with very large vaults of data will turn that into an asset, monetize it by authenticating. So to what extent do we have a privacy concern from the end of authenticators and what the work that they do? In other words, when I am dealing with bigstore.com, but I'm routed through an authenticator, every time I do that, if I'm continuing to add to a profile that is a data mining opportunity, does that lead to concerns? So those are the three hypos, and I hope that we can keep them in mind as we go through our comments this afternoon. And then I'd just like to pass it off first to Ira, and then let's move down the table.
Thanks, Bill. Good afternoon, everyone. Just make a couple of quick introductory points, because I believe we're limited to 3 minutes apiece, right?
You're very disgruntled about this. Yeah, I'd like to, yeah.
So my role at Microsoft is I'm a regulatory lawyer. I provide compliance counseling to product teams developing products, and I also represent the company in regulatory, legislative, other external forums. And I've been there a long time, so I was at Microsoft and played a pretty significant role around that company's participation in P3P initiative. I was on the receiving end of a certain passport complaint that Mark's familiar with. But
that complaint?
Yeah, that one. But I'm now Kim's lawyer. So from my perspective, which for current purposes is kind of more narrowly focused on what it means to be, you know, a regulatory lawyer at a large software provider who's been there for a while, I'm cautiously optimistic. I think in comparison to some of the earlier remarks at the panel this morning, I think that user-centric web identity technology and tools does have enormous potential to achieve privacy protection. And I think that authentication, if done badly, and it has been done badly for a very long time, raises many, many privacy concerns. But that this user-centric approach, if done correctly, and I think Kim Cameron has really captured something in the laws of identity. And again, from my narrow perspective, I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to have a client who writes the laws of identity as compared to some of my other clients. I think it really is a step forward, and I think it provides some very significant design choices that, if followed, avoid the pitfalls of bad authentication, and is very capable of protecting privacy in a number of ways that we can discuss further. I also think that there's some interesting contrast between this user-centric identity technology, MP3P, that we can come back to as well. That said, I think there's still a very significant role for law. I don't think that the technology itself is going to get us everything that we need. And I think particularly in the U.S., what's been missing for many years is comprehensive federal privacy legislation. But I think that's beginning to get back on the table. There's a hearing tomorrow, as it happens, in a House subcommittee on privacy legislation. There'll be a number of companies at that time announcing support for comprehensive privacy legislation in the U.S., and I think that's another important development that's worth exploring.
Mark, you want to go next?
Okay, great. I'm just going to make a few comments. For folks who don't know, my group, EPIC, began in 1994, largely out of an effort to preserve the freedom to develop technologies to safeguard privacy. We were at that time actually battling the Clinton administration over the Clipper escrowed encryption scheme. We got a group of technical experts and legal scholars together who reviewed the proposal, thought it was a bad idea. We sent the letter to the White House, signed by about 40 people, posted it on the internet. People looked at the letter and said, you know, you make a lot of very good points. Could you please add my name to your letter? And in the span of about 6 weeks, we got almost 50,000 signatures on that letter. It became the first internet petition. We printed it out in really large font, so it would take up a lot of paper, delivered it to the White House. It seemed like a big deal at the time. Of course, nowadays, 50,000 people is like a chat room on AOL, so maybe it's not quite the same. I tell this story only because I came to a lot of these issues a fierce believer in promoting techniques that would safeguard privacy, and particularly techniques of anonymity. And I spent a lot of time also trying to think about what is a genuinely privacy-enhancing technology. I think it's actually critical to have a good problem statement. User-centric is one element, but I think there are many others. But I also came to believe that law was necessary essentially to internalize the cost of not having good privacy. That if you didn't force companies to bear the cost for the misuse of personal information, for stolen laptops, and a whole host of other activities that might pose a risk to their customers and clients, there would never really be the commercial incentive to develop the type of privacy and security techniques that were necessary. Now, I think for 10 years it's been hard to make that argument, but actually over the last couple of years it's becoming easier. And I'd like to thank all those folks who are leaving their laptops lying about and all those reporters who report on the stolen laptop data. It has made my life a little bit easier over the last few months. I'm going to conclude, though, with what I see as two very big challenges at this point in time, and where I was somewhat optimistic a decade ago about meeting these challenges, I'm somewhat less optimistic today. The first challenge I'll describe is the security premise, and I think it was actually the question that was asked at the end of the last session by Rebecca McKinnon here with the Berkman Center, which basically said you sort of have to think seriously about the consequences if things don't work, if things break, if things are stolen, if you lose control of your system. I don't think we've actually done enough really hard thinking about that problem. The most, you know, ideal system to safeguard identity, if it's compromised once, could collapse absolutely. And that is actually, in this realm, kind of a scary thought. The second big challenge I see today, which is very troubling, particularly from the viewpoint of a lawyer, is the collapse, I might say, of the lawful access premise. Now, that phrase has been tortured a bit. I always understood lawful access to mean that the government would obtain information through some legal process typically requiring a judge's approval. It got sort of a modification where it basically said it is a basis under which government gets access to information. But where we are today, I'm afraid, is with a belief within the United States that it's permissible, for example, to get access to telephone toll records, that it's permissible to intercept telephone communications of U.S. citizens without judicial approval. Now, unless that problem is fixed, then I think any effort in the private sector to design systems of privacy or of anonymity actually risk a very direct confrontation with a law enforcement agent with the authority and power to compel and to arrest the production of information. Now, I know there are good answers to that problem, and Roger may tell us some of those about how it could become impracticable to comply with such an order. But the critical check in our legal system has always been that requirement of judicial oversight. And so I see in these two areas, the security and the requirement of judicial review, new challenges that didn't seem quite so pressing 10 years ago.
Well, I think to kind of pick up where Mark left off, I don't know who I trust less to safeguard privacy, business or government. I mean, you're talking about the people who have implemented the warrantless telephone collection undertaking with an absolutely straight face arguing that it was completely legal. You want those people to craft a law that's going to protect your privacy? I don't think so. You've got business on the other hand, and Microsoft has now stepped up to the plate in a lot of ways, said it is time to set some standards here. But the problem I have on that side, I've had since I was a Federal Trade Commissioner 10 years ago, and Mark and I used to get into very heated arguments about this. Legislation is a very blunt instrument. It's rarely effective. It has unintended consequences that you can't imagine, and it's largely shaped by commercial interests. So if you can imagine a, quote, privacy law that preempts all 50 states from, you know, setting a higher standard and basically says you have to tell people what you're going to do with their information and then you can do whatever you want. Right? That's the privacy law. Just like right now, what we're talking about for data security is a breach notification law. Well, yeah, we now know that breaches are happening. Some of us knew they were happening for quite a while. But do you think it does anybody any good? Has it started a change? Has it started to move the financial responsibility for these breaches to the data holders?
I would say yes, just since you asked rhetorically.
Well, I think that, Ira, for some companies it has. To be fair, I think Microsoft, IBM, many companies that are here, American Express, do take it very seriously. Do I think the vast majority of Fortune 1000 consumer-facing companies take it seriously? Absolutely not. They are the people in my office after they get caught with, you know, unencrypted laptops, open systems, no thought to the value that they need to place on the security of data they hold. There are exceptions, I grant you, and I think you've been a real leader in that.
I don't think they're just exceptions. No. And I think that the laws are beginning to impose some very significant costs.
The laws
in terms of fines, in terms of corporate reputation, and I don't think that there's just some tiny minority that's...
I can assure you that Designer Shoe Warehouse is going gangbusters, doing better business than they ever had, and the cost to them of their breach was de minimis. Same with Ralph Lauren, same with ChoicePoint, same with card systems.
No, it's not de minimis in each case.
I disagree. That it is.
Give me evidence, and I'll agree with you.
Yeah, I beg to differ. Of a publicly traded company, Ira, go to Oscar. Look up their annual reports, and you can see very clearly, in their own words, the de minimis effect that these breaches have, in their view, on their business.
That would be a false SEC filing.
So I will conclude and say that, look, I don't know where the answer is. I'm skeptical. that it's legislation, because I'm skeptical that we can create legislation that's effective. If you could pass a law that said you may collect data only for the purposes for which it is intended, you may use it only for those purposes, and you may keep it only so long as is necessary to effectuate those purposes, and individuals have a private right of action if you don't do that, I think that might be an effective law. But I don't think we're going to see that law in this country in any of our lifetimes.
That raises a lot of questions, but let's get Roger into the discussion before we go further.
It's the same law that applies when you dig a big hole in your sidewalk. You need it there without a phone number. We think that's reasonable, but we think the law should propose it to countries.
Okay, hold on. Let's get Roger into the discussion first before we...
I'm going to add a whole bunch of other different questions, and then we can jump onto all of
them.
Right,
exactly.
So I come at this from the technology perspective. I work on a network called Tor, which is an anonymity network, or at least when I'm talking to privacy researchers, I call it an anonymity network. When I'm talking to my parents and grandparents, I call it a privacy network. When I'm talking to Walmart and Google and so on, I work on communication security. And when we talk to the U.S. Navy and DOJ and CIA and FBI and so on, we're working on traffic analysis resistant communication networks. And it's all the same security properties that they're looking for. The goal is we have a network out there of about 600 volunteer servers relaying traffic for some hundreds of thousands of users. It's sort of hard to tell. It's an anonymity network. And all of these people need to be blended together in order to get the security properties that they're looking for. Some of them are looking for anonymity. Some of them are looking for privacy. So we've got tens of thousands of people in China who are looking for blocking resistance. We've got people at the CIA who really want to investigate websites without having the web logs show exactly where they're coming from. We've got Navy soldiers in the Middle East right now who are using the same system to connect to their mail servers in Maryland. They don't want anonymity, at least not as they think of it. They don't want somebody watching them locally to learn what their affiliation is, and they don't want somebody watching the servers in Maryland to learn what their current location is. This is all the same sort of anonymity security properties, but they all look at it from a different perspective. And we also have individuals who want security. We've got corporations, EFF lawyers, and so on. So there are a lot of different types of people in on the same platform. So that's point one. So I'm happy to chat about that afterwards. I've been talking to a lot of people for the last day or so, and everybody I've talked to has been looking at the application protocol level. It's all, once we have an internet, let's talk back and forth on it, and then we can negotiate exactly how much of our identity we're going to reveal. And we heard about the laws of identity earlier, one of which is you shouldn't reveal any more than you need to for the transaction. One of the interesting things about the internet right now is that when you connect directly to somebody else and you talk to them, you immediately reveal your IP address, which includes your location and probably quite a bit about your identity, and then you decide how much you're going to actually tell the other person. So this talks a little bit about what Stefan was talking about this morning. When you're building the underlying protocol, the internet or an infrastructure to do this sort of thing, you really want to allow as much flexibility as you can. You want to allow the whole spectrum of options. I want to positively identify myself with 26 different government-issued IDs. I want to just specify my name, and if the website's okay with that, that's fine. So there's a whole spectrum from anonymity to whatever other words we might use, and my goal is to support all of that inside Tor. By default, the network is neutral, and then you can decide what to do on top of that. Okay, so another more exciting point. Isn't Tor helping bad people on the internet? I get this question a lot. There's another rephrasing. There was a question from the earlier panel that I saw up on the board that said, surely the most difficult problem to tackle for allowing access to identity information is international jurisdiction. My answer to that is, yes, international jurisdiction does mess things up, but it's a lot worse than that. What is this identity anyway that we're tracking down? If we're going to have a big escrow system and we trace who did what on the internet, what is the final piece of identity that we learn that shows who they are? Is it an address? Is it a full name? Is it a social security number? Is it an IP address? We have no strong identifiers out there, and the criminals are great at co-opting every single thing that we use out there and putting somebody else's identifier in place of what they just did. So I was talking to the DOJ fellow earlier about that, and it's great to write down IP addresses. This brings in data retention. but it's always going to be some grandmother's IP address when you come down to it. So there are a lot of different issues there that bring up a lot of points. And the last one is, we need help. Tor is a couple of people. We had funding from the Navy. We had funding from EFF. We've just recently gotten a bit of funding from Voice of America. So if you know anybody who wants an underlying network infrastructure to be secure or private or anonymous or traffic analysis resistant, depending on which organization you come from, let me know. And also, we need help advocating this to people. So educating the world about how well off the bad guys are compared to the good guys and what sort of security we need.
So I'd like to move to questions now. What I'd like to propose we do is gather a couple of questions from both the question tool and the floor all at once, and then see if we can sort of group them in a way that lets the panelists respond in the hopes of getting to more questions total. So maybe, Mike, you want to start by vocalizing one of them.
Sure. Mike Jones from Microsoft. So in reaction to Christine's assertion that we would never see a privacy law of that character, I'm getting conflicting information. 2 months ago, I was at a identity symposium at Georgetown where the acting privacy commissioner for Homeland Security was present. And the way she described it to me was, at least all federal government programs are already under such strictures that they have to define what the data is collected for. It has to be audited for that purpose. They have to destroy it when they're done. Now, I understand executive order may cause some programs to be outside that realm. But for the vast majority of it, isn't it the case that at least the government has already imposed that on itself?
Answer, but also there's a question on the board that a couple of people voted for. Could there be value in updating the FIPs in an attempt to discourage rolling out? So I think they're related questions, so yeah. Maybe you can address them both.
You know, I think the government talks a good game. I assume you're talking about Maureen Cooney, who's a terrific person and really good on these issues. The problem is, when the government puts limits on its collection and use of data, it defines the period for which the data is useful, the extent to which they need the data. So, you know, if you've got an FBI file, trust me, it's not going away. You know, and then the FBI file links to the IRS file, which links to the Social Security file. Generally, there's a higher level of obstacle that has to be overcome for the government to link that kind of data together. There are some mechanisms in place, but, you know, I think Mark touched on it. The Fourth Amendment's going down the drain. So I'm not sure that, government can articulate what the standards are. I'm not sure they're being very robustly enforced.
Well, these are actually excellent questions also that have been submitted. But I mean, the key law here is actually the Privacy Act of 1974, and that's the legislation, at least as to the federal government, that said when you collect and use information about U.S. citizens, you have an obligation to safeguard privacy. Now, what's really interesting is I've given you a sentence summary, but in truth, it is a very detailed bit of legislation that incorporates fair information practices, that deals with risks like data retention, that gives some accountability and some enforcement and transparency and oversight. I mean, it was a brilliant bit of legislating more than 30 years ago. And by the way, it was technologically neutral. I mean, no one said, you know, PDP 10 or VAX 370 or whatever. They said if you're collecting information about people, you need to safeguard it. And I would say over the last, 30 years, the work of privacy advocates, largely with respect to the U.S. federal government, has been to try to ensure the enforcement of the Privacy Act. Now, we are constantly in battles over the exemptions that they seek. You know, this case involving the disclosure of the Veterans Affairs data is actually very interesting. I mean, that's hugely actionable under the Privacy Act, and those suits are being brought. So, and I also, I mean, I'm going to side here with Ira, which I don't get to do very often, so I might as well take advantage of the opportunity. But I will side with Ira against Christine. I mean, I think the prospects for good privacy legislation in the U.S. are actually clearly on the increase. I attended Senator Clinton's speech last Friday at the American Constitution Society. It was a very forceful articulation of campaign for new privacy law in this country, and frankly, I think people kind of have 9/11 fatigue. I just don't know how many more times a federal government official can say to an audience about privacy, we'd like to do this, but hey, 9/11, I mean...
What would you define as meaningful privacy legislation?
Well, I think extending fair information practices to the private sector and enforcing the Privacy Act against the federal agencies through some meaningful agency and oversight, and really promoting techniques of privacy and anonymity.
Including consent, access, and minimization?
Minimization, absolutely.
Consent absolutely. And access, do you think that'll get through?
Yeah.
See, I don't see it, Mark. I hope you're right, but I don't see it happening.
Right.
No.
Well, you see, the other way, I mean, Christine and I used to argue all the time, so this is nothing new. We're kind of friendly about it, but 10 years ago it was over legislation. But I think, in fact, the effect of security breaches, I mean, you're right, you know, companies like DSW and ChoicePoint are doing very well these days. Nonetheless, the American public's concern about privacy has clearly been on the rise over the last year in a way that we haven't seen since prior to 9/11. And that's fueling the decisions of lawmakers and Congress and making it easier for both Democrats and Republicans to say we need to legislate. Now, it may not be good legislation.
I don't want to monopolize this, but it's interesting to say that Americans' privacy concerns are increasing when, if you go over to Bed Bath Beyond or Lindens and Things, one of those big consumer-facing companies, and just stand there while people check out, and the cashier, as you're paying with cash or with a credit card, will ask you for your phone number. And I've stood there just because I have nothing better to do for an hour at a time. And usually there's not one person who refuses to give their phone number. It's astonishing to me.
We shop at Bed and Bath.
So let's collect a couple of questions so we have a little a critical mass. And if you can go to the mics or you can put your hand up and the mic will come to you either way. So do you want to go ahead?
Thank you. My name is Daniel Perry. I'm an attorney. I'm also a former judge, so I have some knowledge about the Fourth Amendment. And Christine, I share your concerns that the Fourth Amendment's going down the tubes, but let me say this. I don't know that it's ever going to go completely down the tubes. I think it's just getting a different wrinkle. And by that I mean, as an example, the recent Supreme Court ruling that said they don't need to knock in order
right,
to execute.
No knock,
okay.
Yeah.
I always thought it was a little ludicrous that you would execute a search warrant and knock to let people know you're coming in anyway. That's more help to keep a police officer from getting shot than anything else. My point is this, though. I agree with you, and I'm going to side with you over Mark and Ira for a moment.
Since, thank God.
One lawyer should always come to the rescue of another lawyer, I think.
Oh, but you got so many choices in this
table. That's okay.
Everyone but Roger.
Our lawyers are bigger than their lawyers. Okay? Here's the bottom line. As a litigator and as an ex-judge, I can tell you that I have consulted with people who are victims of so-called identity theft, which, by the way, I don't really like that phrase because I don't think it is a theft. But the reality is that the vast majority of people can't prove damages.
Right.
In other words, those 26 million veterans' records that were released, of those 26 million records, the chance that those would ever find their way to the hands of some identity thief and be used to harm one of those veterans is so remote as to almost be ridiculous. I mean, it is a very minor threat. Studies have shown repeatedly that people can't prove that they've been harmed by this. Oh, they've been inconvenienced. Right. They've been probably upset. But when you get into a court of law and you say, I want damages, judge, you can only prove zero. And so therefore, some recent cases have resulted in dismissals because the plaintiffs couldn't prove damages. So brings me to my point, which is that if your legislation doesn't have a private cause of action and a presumption of damages, you're wasting your time. And to be honest with you, while I agree with Ira and Mark that the data notification statutes are having an impact, they're going about it the wrong way, not them, but the legislation. Because I firmly believe that if you merely say to the corporations, here's a layer of expense that you now have to incur anytime there's a data breach, you're really doing the wrong thing. You should be saying, stop the data breaches from the beginning. Don't just put it into the cost of doing business. I mean, that to me is ludicrous. So I just wanted to say to you, the legislation, if it doesn't have a private cause of action and presumption of damages, there's not a lawyer alive that's going to want to take one of these cases and sue on behalf of these people because you can't prove damages.
I can give a quick answer to this. I mean, I drafted privacy laws 20 years ago, and you would routinely put in stipulated damages when you created a private cause of action for the simple reasons it's very difficult to establish in monetary terms what a privacy harm is, even though the harm is real. So virtually all privacy laws in the United States will have, you know, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, it's $200 or $500. I did the Video Privacy Protection Act, that was $2,000. The interesting question, though, that was before the Supreme Court a few years ago, which we got involved with concerning Privacy Act damages, was whether it was under adverse impact standard or an actual damages standard. And then there were just two different ways to read what Congress wrote in 74, and you had circuits going in different directions. And we had argued that adverse impact, which wouldn't require showing of actual monetary damages, should be sufficient. And unfortunately, we lost that. Now, I say it's unfortunate because it's going to come up now in the VA litigation. And so here's an interesting thing for lawyers to think about. If it is the case, after the Supreme Court's ruling in Doe v. Chau, that to get Privacy Act damages, you have to show actual harm, which is, I think, what the court said, then instead of suggesting, as the VA department has done, that veterans go out and get free credit reports, they should actually pay the cost of the credit report, right? I mean, you got to have something. You went out and had to purchase a credit report because you learned that your personal information was improperly disclosed by a federal agency who had it in their possession. Now you've got some actual damages. Now, where you go from there is a very interesting question, but I think one of the things you're going to see in the litigation will be the purposeful effort to create at least a foothold of actual damages because of the court's interpretation of that issue that you're raising in a case just a few years ago, Doe v. Chau.
Right. I would agree. The Fourth Amendment point, I think that we don't know where it's going to go. I think the Fourth Amendment is hanging very precariously in the balance, and I think that the next two appointments to the Supreme Court are going to be extremely critical in determining how robust the Fourth Amendment is as we move into the information age.
Okay, let's see where the microphones are. I think there's one to the left and one to the right here. If you can ask those questions.
This is David Mack from Boston College. I just wanted to add a personal note to the discussion. I was one of the recipients of a letter from the VA via the IRS stating that my personal accounts or Social Security number may have been released and or stolen. And initially, I'll admit that I was shocked and to have received two of these letters within a six-month period, one from the Boston Globe, which used our subscriber information as packing material, apparently, and then the VA administration.
But you weren't on the Boston College data spill?
I was not. I
you almost had a trifecta.
My colleague here, Tom, I initially was shocked at, first of all, how long my data has been resident with the VA, even though I've been inactive from military service from 1997, and that was just on the reserve roster. My last active duty date was 1995, so it surprised me. I've never made any claims against the VA in terms of GI Bill or housing loans, and to still have my data potentially released was quite a shock. And at the same time, I realized I think the odds of my data being used against me are quite small. Yet, I think the sort of extent of the number of incidents of these data releases and losses just might actually be more worrisome for me now than if they were isolated incidents. So that's just to address the point that someone mentioned, well, if there were 26 million records lost, what are your chances? But how many more of these data losses are we going to experience? And that's all I have for now.
And there's a mic over here as well.
This is Jeremy Warren from the Department of Justice. Some comments were made earlier, and discussion happened with regard to the Privacy Act and the filing of PIAs, what are called what are called PIAs in government, privacy impact assessments that need to be filed according to the Privacy Act. In my time at DOJ, this has been something that I've seen both at DOJ and at other departments we deal with. A lot of effort goes into and a lot of seriousness is paid to compliance with the Privacy Act. Every system that we create, a lot of work goes into the filing of these in the Federal Register, and from what I've seen, they're done relatively well. They do a pretty good job of describing the kind of information that is kept, the kind of information that's collected, what it's used for, and so forth. And it's definitely something that that the folks who are responsible for it in the various information privacy offices, and now as you start to see more chief privacy officers, it's being taken very seriously in government. The question is enforcement, obviously. You know, to what degree is there compliance to filing the PIAs, and what kind of mechanisms are there for making sure that more organizations are doing it effectively? And the other one is obviously the exceptions. And there are a number of exceptions to the Privacy Act, and exactly where those boundaries lie are not always clear, and of course, you don't know where they are if, you know, when it's silence behind the boundary. So I would love to see something like the Privacy Act be required for, you know, for the commercial space that collects and uses so much of our information without necessarily having any regards to what they have to do with it. I think in some ways the government, very unusual, mm-hmm. the government is setting an example here in terms of trying to be forthright about talking about the way they use that information.
But, you know, I
can I just suggest a shift?
Ira, what do you think?
We have only a few minutes left, so I want to just suggest a shift in focus, which is partly back to a point that Mark made earlier about what is a privacy-enhancing technology. And what I want to focus on in particular, I mean, this is a very necessary conversation to have about what, you know, what policy should look like, how laws should be changed, et cetera. But we're here to talk about identity,
right.
And we're here to talk about specific user-centric identity technology. And I think the question before us is, what does that offer? It's not how to solve Fourth Amendment issues. User-centric identity is not a solution to every privacy problem. It is a solution to certain privacy problems. And as technology, I think we're at a moment in time that's quite unusual in the technology industry, in which not only, you know, Microsoft through the work of Kim, but Liberty Alliance, many of the other firms that were up here earlier today, we're all talking the same talk. We're all talking about consent and control. We're all talking about a plurality of operators. We're all talking about interoperability, and we're all talking about decentralization. Those are very important design choices. So I think at least one more forward-looking and positive question to ask is, what does that map to? What problems does that solve? Where does it need to be supplemented by law? And then, you know, what have we now succeeded at? It's not going to be the entire universe, but it's not insignificant either. So I don't think we should only focus on these larger issues. I think we need to stay focused on the technology under discussion at this conference.
I see Mark wants to respond, and I want Mark to respond. Let me just ask one clarifying question, though, Ira, because in your initial comments, you did talk about the need for, you know, a legal component to the implementation of this kind of technology. And what you just said there sounded a little bit different. Maybe you can kind of reconcile them for us.
Well, I think that the technology brings a great deal to the table. But I think I think asserting identity is mainly about putting claims forward about yourself and doing so in a way that's ideally limiting the disclosure and then limiting uses of it that are different from the reason that you put it forward. And I think it's on that topic in particular that law is required, because none of the identity technologies that I've looked at or that I'm familiar with are ultimately successful in preventing, from a technological standpoint, further sharing of certain data that's disclosed.
Right. Downstream sharing.
In some narrow cases, perhaps you can accomplish that, but not in all cases. So laws addressing third-party use for unrelated purposes then become a significant complement to identity technology. That's just one example.
Do you want to add to that, Mark?
Let me just quickly suggest, following on Ira's comments, how a legal framework might map that. I talked a lot about the Privacy Act. Now, the Privacy Act is a law that generally relates to the collection and use of personally identifiable information. The threshold question concerns the disclosure of identity, right? But even in the drafting of the Privacy Act, there was a lot of sensitivity to the nuance of that moment. So it's not only personally identifiable information, but information that could be personally identifiable, right? And also recognition that certain identifiers pose a unique risk, like the Social Security number. And not surprisingly, the Privacy Act of 74 puts special obligations on the collection use of the SSN, even though, in fact, it's not a person's identity. It just maps almost directly to their identity. Now, the other key issue I just wanted to also raise is that we've been very interested over the years in the legal act of identification. It's very interesting what verbs are associated with that act. I heard people talk about assert identity. Well, it's a very nice thought, but more often than not in the legal realm, when you're talking about the disclosure of identity, you're talking about the compelled disclosure of identity. It's the circumstances under which a person would not otherwise choose to say who they are, but for some reason they're required to do so. So we have a great deal of interest, for example, in the cases that affirm a right of anonymity, that people can speak publicly, can publish, can petition, can go door to door without being required by the state to say who they are. And we also have a concern about a case a few years ago, which some of you may be familiar with, Heibel versus 6th Judicial District, where the state of Nevada said that even though we don't have probable cause to arrest you, the fact that you're acting suspiciously and fail to identify yourself, provides the basis for our arrest. And we were very concerned about the outcome of that case. So I think as we think about this, at least partly through a legal lens, we're going to be concerned about the circumstances under which a person is required to say what their identity is.
Let me jump off that directly because we were running out of time. Can we circle back to the Chinese blogger? Because that's actually a good example of a situation where you have to assume that there is no legal component to the full identity system that's in place, that the technology alone is what's involved because, you know, you have law that's not working and, you know, there's clearly not law that supports that person's ability to not identify themselves, as you say, Mark. What are the considerations in the technology? Maybe we can start with you. What are the considerations in the way that these things are coded that would be important for minimizing potential harm in that scenario? I mean, we don't have to all answer, but I know Roger may have some things to say.
That's a tricky question. So going back to the technology versus law question, and then I'll try to tackle yours, that's why we're working on the technology side, because all of these law questions are uncertain, and who knows what the law is going to be this year or in 5 years or in 10 years or which jurisdiction we're going to try to apply things to. So our goal is to build the infrastructure so that it can be whatever the law wants it to be and whatever various individuals in whatever country need to have in terms of being able to reach websites on the internet or in terms of having security from various people learning what their interests are and putting them on the list. So that's the approach that we take. Can you clarify your question a little bit?
In other words, so you're looking at a situation with the, you know, if you have some of this authenticated identity technology rolled out and made part of everyday internet usage and
in an international way.
Yes, globally, deployed globally. What kinds of characteristics ought it to have to minimize potential harm in places where that we can't count on law to supplement whatever lack there might be in the technology in the situation like Rebecca's friends in China who are dissidents and are trying to communicate? If the Chinese, in that scenario, sort of what are the important things that technologists should be doing in the design of the technology?
We should build the technology to be secure against whatever attackers we're worried about. And then users can use it in a way that they need to use it to achieve whatever ends they need to get. And I'd be really curious to hear the legal answer here to how on earth do we get every corporation, every country, every person in the world to agree to the same legal situation and put all of their...
We don't, clearly.
So I don't understand how that's going to happen, so it's hard for me to answer. I mean, technologically, the answer is give people the tools that they want to do what they want to do.
And do you have any sense, any of the panelists have any sense of what those tools are, what they ought to look like in...
There are,
to be privacy-enhancing tools, in other words, in scenarios where you can't count on law.
There are a couple of pieces to that. What Tor does right now is, if you can reach the Tor network, then you get security in a wide variety of ways. For example, somebody watching you locally sees that you're connecting to the Tor network, but they don't know what your final destination is. Also, when you eventually connect to the website, they don't know what your current location is. The U.S. Navy soldiers care about this because of physical harm issues. Some people don't like being profiled by ChoicePoint or DoubleClick or whatever it will be next year. There are a lot of different variations of that. That's if you can get to the Tor network. If you're living in China, it's not the case yet because only 10 or 20 or 30,000 people use Tor. But it's not so hard to figure out what all the IP addresses for the Tor network is and just blacklist the whole set. So the next sort of property you want to get at that point is some sort of blocking-resistant communication network. You want some sort of more decentralized or more peer-to-peer or more social network-y approach where you can use a lot of different people around you in order to get through some sort of government class firewall.
I would supplement that with just one thought, which is I don't think you'll get worldwide consensus on laws that enhance privacy. Rather, I think
right.
The important thing is to build the tools in such a way that they're readily available and that these specific characteristics are built in from the get-go such that, number one, for a government to suppress them requires specific decision and action on their part,
mm-hmm.
rather than simply relying on the fact that the tools are built in such a way that they just won't be offered in this jurisdiction. You should always make them available in a pervasive way. And number two, I think that puts dissonance in any given country. And at a minimum, you have to put them in a position that they're no worse off than they are today. So today, the Chinese government has sufficient access to, in many cases, identify the dissidents that they want to go after. You don't want to make that any worse by building tools that make it easier to do that. But if you at least offer that choice and then force the governments to take action, I don't think you've done any harm, and I think you may have enhanced the situation.
So here is the privacy advocate's nightmare scenario, that a lot of very brilliant, very well-intended engineers design a system of disaggregated identification that truly allows people to control disclosure of aspects of personality, highly context-dependent, great privacy, great security, and then something comes along, the next 9/11, whatever it is, and government comes in and says, we need to turn this upside down, because what you have is, of course, the network of personality of everybody that we would like to reconstruct for complete surveillance. And I'm sure this is in the back of people's minds, but you see, we actually kind of lived through this 10 years ago with a debate over the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. I always thought, understanding the basic premise of the Fourth Amendment, that the government gets authority to conduct a search, goes and does the search, and encounters the world as it is. Fourth Amendment is a law of physics that says what you are seeking, you will receive. It's legal authority to undertake a search. But you see, the Digital Telephony Act and the recent decision of the FCC effectively extending it to VoIP services attempts to turn the Fourth Amendment into a law of physics and say, in effect, if you are offering a communication service, you need to design it so that we can get access under appropriate circumstances when we come to you. And I think there needs to be a very good answer to that challenge. That was really my second challenge. What will be your answer?
Right.
With the best of intent and the best design, what will be your answer after the next 9/11 when someone says, oh my goodness, we just can't have anonymous transactions anymore?
I'd like to just get one more question if we can in before our time is up, and there's a couple people who have been patiently waiting, so perhaps we can have that question there.
I'd like to see if I can get Mark and Christine talking to each other about what the political connections would have to be to have privacy protection against the government. It could go over to the private sector. Fair information practices put into law. I'm thinking of the examples of the HIPAA regulations, which are disclosure regulation. law is a form of technology, politics, law is a form of politics. What would be needed for the two of you to come together and say, hey, we've got the conditions to protect the Fourth Amendment and have a privacy protective law?
Well, I don't know what the conditions would be. I think Mark and I probably agree on what the elements of a good law are, more or less. I guess where I would disagree is I don't see it happening anytime soon, primarily because there's too much money to be made in the information age from aggregating, dicing, slicing, and, you know, monetizing data. So until you get an economic shift, it's very hard for me to see that the interests will align in a way that would permit meaningful privacy legislation. And, you know, I think there was a question posed at one point earlier that how does the Fourth Amendment relate to user-centric identity? I would say if the user-centric identity tools that are developed do not help us protect the Fourth Amendment, they are a failure. Because as Mark has pointed out, the problem is after the next 9/11, what will happen is that the government will begin to go to all the holders of data and say, we need your data. Here's our warrant, or maybe not, depending on what part of the government it is. And you have lost any expectation that you ever had of privacy, which is why I like the question, is the greatest risk of personal identity abuse from the U.S. government, corporations, or foreign individuals? I don't worry about foreign individuals. It's the intersection of the government and corporations. Because believe it or not, corporations have way more data about us than the government does. Government may have more interesting data on some people, but the vast majority of data that's held about us is held in private hands. Witness the collection of the telephone records.
So I hate to leave us on this note, so I'll insert another comment. We are better off with identity technology that is not highly centralized, that provides user consent and control, and if the nightmare scenario then occurs, makes it more difficult, not less difficult, for the government to step in and demand. If they step in and demand, and the entity they're demanding it from simply doesn't have that data, because they come to a company that's deployed technology that is just, you know, a pointer to some other place,
right,
then the entity says, I'm sorry, I don't have that data.
So
I'm saying we're better off with well-designed identity technology than with no design.
That's what we said about Passport.
A longer conversation, my friend.
Well, a longer conversation is probably the most appropriate way to end this panel, because obviously we've only scratched the surface on most privacy issues, but I hope that we've set the stage for some further discussion. I know some of the Track A sessions tomorrow are going to drill down deeper into these topics. And on Wednesday, of course, we're going to get together and mash it up, and we're going to solve the entire range of technological privacy problems right there in the MIT Media Lab. I know we are. So thank you very much, and please thank the panelists on our behalf.